Very good. Thank you. We got some more in here. Actually, it's quite good. Not so many. Here we go. Some questions. Dear Ajahn, can a person who experiences occasional episodes of epilepsy be benefited from meditation practice? Story, there was one of our monks years ago, his name was Ananda, and he was in the Vietnam War, and he actually volunteered to be a US Marine so he could get even more tough. He was really sort of actually a very bad guy when he was young. And he joined the US Marines, and in a firefight in Vietnam, he got shot in the back of the head. Fortunately, he survived, but having missed, you know, some of his brain was taken out. You know, it was really difficult to shave his hair because he had this big cavity in his back. But he had epileptic fits as a result of the injury. And he said that when he had his epileptic fits, it was always, you know, very difficult to deal with. But little by little, he became more aware of what triggered the epileptic fits. He could actually see them coming earlier and earlier and earlier. Until he said he could catch them. He could actually see just the pathway which the epileptic fits would follow. Called it earlier and earlier and earlier. And so that in the latter part of his life, he died many years ago. But when he got to that particular point that he knew that the epileptic fit was going to come, he caught it that early. He stopped whatever he was doing, go into a darkened room and just relax and rest. And so that was the last of his epileptic fits. Basically, he couldn't say cured himself because the tendency was still there, but he just avoided them simply by catching them earlier and earlier and earlier. It's like a train leaving the station. If the train is on the tracks 3 kilometers down the line, it's really impossible to stop. It's built up momentum. But if you can catch that train when it's just leaving the station, the driver can put on the brakes, it stops immediately. It hasn't got as much momentum. So he managed to catch his epilepsy really early. He noticed, you know, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. He noticed the process, caught it early, and he could avoid it. You know, it's actually amazing just to show how meditation, especially this mindfulness, you know, actually just made him avoid those epileptic fits. Basically, that's a typical case of meditation and mindfulness, and it worked. Could you please share with us how you met Ajahn Chah at first place to fulfill your goal? I cannot understand why you were born in England and not in Thailand. Yeah, it's because of some very bad karma. I got born in England. And because I got born in England, and you know what the English did to places like Sri Lanka, Singapore and Malaysia, so I have to spend a lot of my time these days in Singapore, Malaysia and Sri Lanka, repaying the bad karma of my ancestors. But I don't know why, but you know, when you get reborn in these places, you make the best use of it. So, you know, I do make the best use of, you know, being able to teach in the English language and understanding like Western culture, and also, you know, the great education I got in a university like Cambridge, which was all paid for by a government at that time, or actually through scholarships. So it's actually wonderful that I was actually born there. And how you met Ajahn Chah, it was that, this interesting story, if you don't know this, was that, you know, I was a Buddhist for many years. Before I even went to Thailand. About 7 years I was a Buddhist. And ever since I was 16, just reading a book. And when I went to listen to talks by monks, I heard from the Thai tradition, you could become a monk temporarily. And you know, there was no shame in if you disrobed. And I thought that it was about, I was 23, now, I had just done 1 year as a school teacher. I just finished a relationship with a girlfriend. And he had this wonderful opportunity. I was free. And I knew that if I carried on a bit longer, you'd meet someone and then you'd sort of get married and get stuck in the household life. And, you know, I was actually quite looking forward to that. You know, I wasn't sort of a monk. At least I didn't realize it until I became a monk. And so I just had this marvelous opportunity. I had a good career, I could go back any time. So I told my friends and my mother, my father was dead, I'm going to Thailand to become a monk, you know, just for a couple of years. So how stupid you are. I said, well, I'll become enlightened and get that out of the way, and then I can go back to my usual career. I hadn't a clue what enlightenment was. But then I went to the Thai temple in London, you know, just wanting to become a monk. And he did meet some people who, I met this one man, he said, oh, he was a monk in Thailand. And I asked him where you can go. He was a good teacher. And he had been with Ajahn Chah, and he didn't tell me about it. Later on, when I met him in Thailand, I said, why didn't you tell me about Ajahn Chah? You know what he said? He said, when I look to you, you look to be too happy to become a monk. And then people had this really weird idea that you had to be suffering and in great misery to want to become a monk. And I was happy even as a layperson. But that didn't stop me from wanting to serve ordain. And so I went over to Bangkok, because that's the Thai temple in London, that's where they were from. And so I was meditating in sort of Bangkok, and these a couple of monks came in, and the first time I looked at them I thought, wow, your robes are very dirty. And of course those were forest monks. And one of them was Sumato, he invited me up to have a look at Ajahn Chah's monastery. So you know, I just went up there for a look. And when I first saw Ajahn Chah, I thought this was really a crazy, stupid monk. Because, you know, we were doing some chores, and one of the chores we were doing, because his mother had just died, was making these little baskets. And I remember Ajahn Chah coming over to me and looking at my basket and said, that's a very wonderful basket, well done. And I looked at my basket, looked at other, my basket was hopeless. And I said, I'm not going to be flattered like that, who do you think you are? And I was very upset with him. I thought, this is a really stupid monk. He's not going to get me through flattery. But the event which turned me all around, which made me stay there, was when I was busy making my basket, and another monk, you know, wanted to ask some questions of Ajahn Chah. And through the interpreter, he was talking with Ajahn Chah. I was in earshot, and you're just making a basket. Interesting to see what Ajahn Chah was saying, because this was This was actually the same monk in the Open the Door of Your Heart who was thinking about his girlfriend. And Ajahn Chah said, ask her for a bottle of excrement. The same monk. So he was actually asking questions on the Dhamma. And he asked a question in English. It was translated. Ajahn Chah said something in Thai and translated back. And it was a very strange experience, because Ajahn Chah was not answering this guy's questions. He was answering my questions. And I would think of a question, and then this monk would ask another question in English, and the translation would come back, and it was my question being answered. And that was really weird. So Ajahn Chah was reading my mind and answering my questions. And I asked this monk afterwards, his name was Gary, he said, what do you think of Ajahn Chah's answers to your questions? I couldn't understand them, it made no sense at all. He said, yeah, because he wasn't answering you, he was answering me. And that was, you know, quite impressive, to see sort of Ajahn Chah reading your mind and answering my questions. And they were really good questions. So, you know, from that time you realize this was actually quite a special monk. He didn't catch me with flattery, but he caught me with just some really deep wisdom. And he was a great monk to live with, because he was unconventional, very funny, and, you know, a bit fierce, but inspiring. And the one time which I really got inspired with him, he would have like one novice as his attendant for a long time. And the novice was the only one who could go into his private quarters. And then one day, and I must have been about 5 or 6 years as a monk, I was hanging around his hut and he asked me to go up, to go and fetch something. And I was really excited, the first time I was allowed into the private quarters of Ajahn Chah. And by this time, he was really famous, people giving all sorts of gifts and stuff. You know, the Queen of Thailand, all these major generals and rich business people. You know, he was really, really well known by this time. And I went up there, and as soon as I went inside his room, where he meditated and slept, you know, you just, oh, wow, this is incredible. There's nothing there. It was just a grass mat, a wooden pillow, and one robe, I think, on the line, his spare robe. Nothing else. And I thought, wow, this is a monk who does live a simple life. And even though he's very famous, he could have, you know, a queen bed. He could have all sorts of knickknacks and all sorts of books and stuff. He had nothing. That's a sign of a good monk and good nun who has few possessions. And I thought, okay, I'm very happy. I'm very lucky to be with a monk who doesn't just teach, but actually lives the Dhamma. Few possessions. So that was wonderful. Dear Ajahn, was Gautama Buddha born a million years after Kassapa Buddha or a few thousand years? What is a kalpa in human years? Oh my goodness. But interestingly, if you don't know this, you know, in many traditions, you know, we have these commentaries which have, for example, the Ten Jatakas. And in Thailand they have this thing called Waisantara. And that was supposed to be the last birth of the Buddha. And as a Westerner, when I heard that was actually gross. Because here was this prince, and he was married, he had two kids. And they said in order to perfect his generosity, he not only gave away his wife, but he gave away his kids who were beaten and just abused. And this was supposed to be a responsible parent. I thought, this is really gross. As a Westerner, because I wasn't born in that culture, but as you know, do you have Waisantara in Sri Lanka? Yeah, I mean, if you have a look at it and you actually contemplate it, it's a terrible thing. No sort of good person would do anything like that. And this is supposed to be the Buddha in a previous life. So I was always really suspicious of those. Because many of those books were actually written a long time after the Buddha and were mostly folk tales. But no, the real Jataka tale, if you don't know this, is in Gatikara Sutta. This is one of the teachings in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is in the heartland of the sutras. And there Gatikara was a potter in the time of the Buddha. This is a good story because it gives you some understanding of, you know, especially what an anagami means, a non-returner, that stage of enlightenment, because Gatikara was a non-returner, a lay person. And the only reason why he didn't become a monk under Kassapa the Buddha, because he had two parents who were blind and no one else to look after them. So Gatikara, he would be a potter and that he would look after his parents. And he said, if my parents had died, then he would have gone to become a monk straight away. And even though he was a potter, he would, number one, he would never dig the earth himself in case he injured any animals, any worms. He'd wait for, like, I think it was rats or rabbits to dig holes, or the farmers to make their dikes on the paddy fields, he'd ask for some of the clay. And that's how he made his pots. And also, he would never sell anything. Now, sometimes, you know, monks, nuns get into making business, selling this and amulets and all this other stuff. But, you know, this is a lay person. He would just put the pot on the shelf with a sign, if anyone wants a pot, take one. If anyone wants to leave some rice and veggies or lentils, just leave some. And you know, there would be no sort of transactions, no sort of asking for things. It was all done donation both ways. And that's actually a sign of someone who's, you know, basically left the world. And anyway, this Gatikara, he was anagami, non-returner, just looking after his parents. He had a best friend called Jyotipala, Palapana. Look at this one. I think Jyotipana. Pana, Pala? Which one was it? Pala, Jyotipala, okay. Jyotipala was his best friend. And he always wanted his best friend Jyotipala to come and see Kassapa the Buddha. And Jyotipala would always abuse Kassapa the Buddha, saying he was a hopeless case, a lazy good for nothing, getting a proper job, you know, just the usual things which sometimes, you know, non-Buddhists will say about the monks and the nuns. But eventually he tricked his best friend to see the Buddha. And of course, once he actually came in the presence of the Buddha and listened to a talk, this Jyotipala was converted straight away. And you know, because he had no duties to blind parents, Jyotipala became a bhikkhu. And in the rest of the sutta, it just leaves Jyotipala as a bhikkhu under Kassapa the Buddha and goes off to talk about what happened next with Gatikara. But at the end of this sutta, taught by the Buddha said, that was me. I was Jyotipala. And when I heard that, Jyotipala, you know, was the Buddha in a previous life, and that it wasn't that long ago, because Gatikala, you know, when you're an anagami, you pass away, you get reborn in the what's called the Sudawasa, the pure abodes. And if you look in the Devaputta Samyutta, just this is another part of the Pali Canon, there you see all these people coming to see the Buddha after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And one of the people who comes to congratulate the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, again this is in the Samyutta Nikaya, is Gatikara. So he comes to see his old mate. So, you know, we were from the same village in the time of Kassapa. Now I've been reborn in the Sudawasa, now you've finally become a Buddha. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu to my good friend. And that, you know, pretty much convinces me that this was a very recent birth, not that long ago. In fact, the evidence is very compelling that that was the previous birth of our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, as the monk Jyotipala in the time of the Kassapa the Buddha. And also this is, you know, just circumstantial evidence, but it makes a lot of sense to me. You know the story when the Buddha was born and spoke and said, this is my last life? How could he have known that? Because no one can tell the future unless there was something certain about him saying, this is my last life. Unless he was a once-returner. He knew that this was his last life. He was a Sakadagami. And we all know he came from the Tusita realm, according to all of these scriptures. And there's another sutta which says Sakadagamis, for the most part, take their last life in the Tusita realm. So there's a lot of compelling evidence that, and you can imagine somebody with that degree of spiritual power, you know, who's going to be a Buddha soon, you know, was living as a monk under another Buddha. Surely he must have got something. It's quite understandable, you know, that you don't get jhanas, you know, studying under me. I'm not a Buddha, but if I was a Kassapa the Buddha or Gautama the Buddha and you came for a 9-day retreat, you'd expect to get something. You know, I'm just Ajahn Brother. Buddha, crikey. So you'd expect Jyotipala to have got something under the Buddha, and obviously I'd have thought you'd got Sakadagami. And that's why, from the Kassapa the Buddha to the Tusita realm, Tusita realm back to the human realm, and that's where he finished as our Buddha. Makes a lot of sense to me. And not that long ago, because, you know, Gatikara was still around. Interesting. Anyway, next question. Dear friends, I ask for your forgiveness if I seem to be unfriendly and refuse to talk during my time here. I'm trying to keep noble silence as much as I can, as I've found that it's helped me to focus more on the inside. I seek your kind consideration to keep the not-so-important chatter to a minimum. Your kind cooperation is very much appreciated. Sending all of you inner peace, thank you, and thank you to your roundness. That's a very beautiful way you put that, man, because, yeah, I mean, sometimes people think they need to chatter, but please remember that other people are hearing you as well. So if you are going to have a chatter, please go away in, you know, up the road, towards the gate, or places where people can't hear you. And if you see somebody meditating in the forest somewhere, just don't go talking just past them. And especially in your cottages, that really should be, you know, a no-chatter area. 6 people in your cottage, you know, you're one of those. And maybe just one person there just really, really, really likes the silence. So just out of kindness to them, try and be quiet. Especially during the day. Sometimes if it's just, you know, after the talks here, or if it's just lunchtime, yeah, you know, this is a busy time. But other times of the day, really, really be careful. Try not to disturb others. So it's a very nice way you put that. Thank you. Dear Ajahn, was Gautama Buddha... Oh, I did that one a million years ago. Dear Ajahn Brahm, instead of watching the breath, is it enough just to go within and feel the kindness and joy while doing so? Yes, exactly. I think this came yesterday, but this particular question was answered this morning by the simile of following a stream when you're caught in the mist and the fog. Because it goes downhill, you know it's going in the right direction. So feeling the kindness and joy is going in the right direction. So follow that. Now, not just the breath. Because many people follow the breath and they think the breath is the only thing to follow. And they forget about the kindness and the joy, the peace. And sometimes they're following the breath at all costs. They get so tense and tight within. Because they're putting far too much effort on it. And forgetting the peace, the mindfulness, the joy is even more important. Just like, you know, some people, they work really hard trying to find money for their family, and they realize what they're finding money for, so they can have peace and happiness with their family. Now, money's not the be-all and end-all, it's there for a purpose. You know, the comfort, health, happiness, security of your family. And sometimes, because we get the priorities wrong, it does mean we sacrifice our family. We don't have time with them, we don't have happiness with them, and our children grow up to be, you know, just basically missing the time with their parents. The parents, but I was working hard for you. Yes, but we didn't want the money, we wanted you. Dear Ajahn, we are halfway through a retreat seeking happiness, but some people look really grumpy and something. Even if we have not yet something that reached or whatever attained that high level of happiness, can we at least pretend to be happy and smile a bit? Yeah, that's a very good... That's very true, because even if you don't have... you're not talking to another person, noble silence. You don't have to be miserable about noble silence. There's nothing noble about misery. So I even say, if those people are keeping strict noble silence, please, when you meet somebody, just smile at them. You know that I do that. I smile at you, laugh at you, play around sometimes, because... I realise that would be really helpful. A little smile just lifts up a person and it shows that things are going well. Especially, you know, when I'm giving a talk or, you know, just finished the meditation, please smile, because I have to look at you. And sometimes after meditation, oh, I think I might as well commit suicide, you're so grumpy. So a smile is really, really nice. And it also, because if you give a smile to someone, you're giving them some happiness. And sometimes that's all that's needed to really get your meditation going. And remember what I said at the beginning, I think from the Dhammacetya Sutta. There the king noticed, you know, in the monastery where the Buddha lived, all the monks were always smiling and happy. That's why he loved to come there. And the Buddha said, yes, that's what happens when your meditation going well, and you're getting insights. You get happy. So, you know, I can tell your achievements by the mouth indicator. If the bottoms are down, you're having you're not meditating well. Horizontal, still not good enough. It goes up a little bit, now you're getting somewhere. It goes way up here somewhere, now you're really rocking in meditation. That's what should be happening. Happiness. You have talked about the health benefits of meditation. How meditation can ease and cure illness and disease. Could you please talk about why some of the greatest Buddhist teachers are afflicted with illness and disease, even the Buddha himself, why they chose not to cure illness and disease that afflicted them? You know, there are some teachers, but some teachers are very angry. And unfortunately, this is the case. And they shout at their disciples. And they're tough! And they go, sit still! And they shout at people. And that's why they get sick. They can't even control their own anger. How can they be kind to their body and make it really, really healthy? So please be careful. You know, there's so many monks, there's so many nuns. You know, some are control freaks. You know that. You can see it. And the one thing I keep telling the monks and nuns, don't think that the lay community don't know what goes on in a monastery. You know, sometimes the monks try to hide it from you. But you go and offer dana there, you see them. And I'm really impressed how you know what's going on in a monastery. You can tell which monks are having a good time, which monks are struggling, which nuns are having a hard time. And you can't hide it, venerables. They know everything which is going on. And that's really quite impressive to me. So you can't hide anything. So if you're a control freak, you're going to get sick. You're tight. Look at my robe. If I'm holding it like this all the time, it's going to break. It's not going to last. If I hold it nice and loose, it's going to last a long time. If you relax. That's why I always say, you know, your body. Your body's only got a certain amount of energy in it, like your car. Your car can only go so many kilometers. So if you exercise your body too much when you're young, you won't have any energy left when you're old. So preserve your energy. I get into big trouble. But anyway, at least, you know, don't sort of have like tension in your mind, because that kills the body more than anything else. And sometimes that's what happens. But there are also things like, Ajahn Chah, because I knew him. And the reason why he had his stroke, he was working too hard, and no one ever let him have a rest. I saw him. I was there. Now, he would get up in the morning. He'd have a bit of peace and quiet in the morning. But even so, you know, monks would come with their problems early in the morning, because that's the only time they could get him. And then all day, you know, be in his hut. People were visiting, asking questions all day. And then in the evening, after the chanting, when the visitors went, that's when the monks would go there and asking questions. So, you know, the guy didn't have any rest. And I think that was the main reason. You know, I work hard, but at least I get some rest. And, you know, I'm very careful not to go on that path, sacrifice too much. And basically, it was a big mistake of Ajahn Chah. He could still be alive many years later if he'd have paced himself and not given so much and said no. So if ever I say no, you know, it's just because I know it's the time to say no and I have to sort of relax and rest and take some time out. So please understand to look after your teachers. But you know what some people say? It's really crazy. They say, Ajahn Bhav, you work too hard. Come and stay with me and I'll look after you. Yeah, sure. You get me by yourself. So if ever I need a rest, I'm not going to go to your house or your monastery or go to where. If I need a rest, I'll rest in Bodhinyana Monastery. I've got my cave there. And the monks are really, really good. If I need a rest, they will protect me. And you won't be able to get close. They say, no, he's resting. And I think that's not nice, that you don't have to run away from your own monastery if you need some rest. So I don't need to go to some resort. You don't need to get me sort of a private beach in the Caribbean to go and have a rest. You know, I just go in my cave and shut the door and say bye-bye. So, but you know, I mean, I understand my health, so I'm doing okay. But this is one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah, really, really huge amount of compassion. Could have been a little bit wiser. Meditation is practice to seek contentment and happiness. But happiness and contentment is needed for stillness, and stillness is needed for samadhi. And jhana, how do I begin? Where do I begin? You begin right here. Now, it's true what you're saying here. It seems you've got to be happy to be content, but you need to be content to be happy. Just the old chicken and the egg. Which comes first? I don't know which comes first, the chicken and the egg. But the chicken doesn't think of that problem. It just lays the egg, and the egg just hatches. The problem with you guys is you keep thinking too much. You should be more like a chicken. Who cares whether there's an egg there, there's a chicken there? It works. So the chicken and egg managed to solve that problem. And, you know, they haven't gone to school and university, so surely you can solve that question. So, happiness and contentment. Are you happy now? You've got some happiness. Are you contented? You can make contentment any time. And you can be still. So it usually a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but it does grow. One of the great ways to get happiness and contentment is inspiration. Be inspired, you know, by the teachings. Inspired. Look, I told this at the AGM of our Buddhist society the other day. I do travel around the world. And all of you people who, you know, supporting, you know, this organization, There's nothing like this in the whole world. Honestly, you have great monks' monastery, a great nuns' monastery, and a Dhammasala. There's nothing like that Dhammasala anywhere in the world. You know, we're for nuns, run by nuns, for nuns, for bhikkhunis. You've got this place, Jhana Grove, this purpose-built place so you can meditate. Lay people, really good teachings, really great food, all brought by visitors, which is really, that just adds joy to the food. And really cheap, so anyone basically can come here. If you really can't afford it, you don't have to ask for scholarships, just ask for your money back and no questions asked. And this is amazing what we have here. And then the talks. I'm amazed at how those talks which you know you give on a Friday night, they go all over the world, literally. To places like Syria, Colombia, places where you can't even get a temple built. But you know the Dharma gets there. So this Buddhist society over here, you know, it's not me, it's all of you who support it and work for it and become committee members. You've done an incredibly great job. So I get inspired. Wow, look what we're doing. This is actually doing something for the world. And you get all these letters of people who say, oh, there was this clinical psychologist. She wrote me a letter. It's in my bag, so my bag's over in there. I just opened it up today. She said she's got, one of her kids has got mild autism. And she reads, he asked, can I have one of Ajahn Brahm's stories this evening? And so she reads, she cuddles her little kid, who's about 6 or 7 years of age, reads a story for one of my books, and she said it's gold. That's what she wrote, it's gold. She has this wonderful time with her kid, and the kid is learning some really, really good techniques to deal with his autism. And his elder brother comes into the room, and he wants to hear it as well. He said, she uses these stories in her practice as a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist, I forget which it was. It's really working. When I see just how far these talks go, how they really, really help, wow, I'm really inspired. And you should be inspired too, because you're part of this. When you get inspiration, wow, you get so happy. And then I just meditate and I think of that letter I just got today, wow, this is cool. And then you're off in your meditation, really deep. Using inspiration, you get happiness and contentment. You know what it's like when it's a problem, there's some problems, some of the abbots are just controlling, they're not being kind, and you think, oh gee, and there's problems with the finances, and somebody's not doing this right, and the internet's not working, and ugh. That is such a downer. There's always two bad bricks in the wall, but for goodness sake, don't look at the two bad bricks. Look at the beautiful bricks. Wow, you really get inspired. That is how you build up happiness and contentment. And you use that as like an investment. You use that in your meditation. You're off, you're away, just beautiful, happy times. And just think of all the people who've come here today, the last week, meditating. You know it's not an easy thing to do, number one, to find time. And to meditate, to keep your 8 precepts, voluntarily, give up your food in the evening. You don't have to do that. You've done that. You've done so many days already. Some of you, the first time you've done that. It's really hard. Well done. Feel inspired that you've done it, you've made it. I know there's some of you over here. Some of you, your sister said, he's not going to make it. And they're so amazed, it's lasted so long. Well done. So you should be inspired by yourself. You get inspiration, you get so much happiness, so much energy. Whew, then you get the stillness and the bliss, you really get off. That's what I do. I'm inspired by you. And I inspire myself. Any excuse to get inspired, I take it. Because it's really nice. When people die, the family will collect the ash. What for? What is the best way to do with the ash, according to the Buddhist tradition? Put it in the ashtray. It's only ash. Get rid of it, for goodness sake. Put it in the ground, leave it in the sea. Is there any relation between this ash and rebirth? Absolutely not. So when I die, I already say what to do at the funeral. I haven't told you what to do with the body. You know, if you have a look outside on Thursday night, tomorrow night, Friday morning, we have the recycling bins. They're yellow. Please put me in the recycling bin. Because if you burn me, that actually is too many greenhouse gases up in the air. It's very expensive as well. It uses up so many fossil fuels to burn a body, a huge amount. So instead of doing that, just put me in a recycling bin. It's taken down to the tip and the animals and the worms eat it. It all gets recycled, you know, without any bad greenhouse gases. That's what I want. So, and it doesn't cost anything. Once a fortnight, they pick up the yellow recycling bin, so put me in a black bag there, in the bin. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. Simple, nice, really cheap. Why not? Why not? Because when you start to keep ashes, especially of monks, it becomes craziness. You have relics. Oh my goodness. Look at all the Buddha relics in the whole world. You know, when I was in Singapore once, they had a relic exhibition. And people were queuing up for hours to go in the relic exhibition. Fortunately, I was a monk, so you know, go VIP or VIM, very important monk, you go straight through. But look, to this relics, there's hardly anything there. You go to Bodhinyana, up in the dining room, you've got more relics there than in the relic exhibitions. You don't have to queue up, and you can actually stay there as long as you like. It doesn't cost anything. So if you want to see relics, we've got heaps of them over there, and they're real relics. Some of them have multiplied. You know, really amazing stuff. But are they the real relics of the Buddha? No. The real relics of the Buddha are the teachings, the Dhamma, the precepts, the meditation. Those are the relics of the Buddha. Unfortunately, these days, we just like to worship things instead of actually what the Buddha left us. And it was one of his teachings. Monks, nuns, lay disciples, do not be an heir to my material things. Be an heir to my Dhamma. The Dhamma Dhyaya Sutta. I always remember that. The real relics of the Buddha is the Dhamma. So please worship those. And then you understand. Relics, yeah, you can put them in the hall there. They're interesting. But don't make too much of a big thing of them. The real relics are the teachings. If you worship them, it means you practice them. You find them very worthy. And then you become really good Buddhists. Now, unfortunately, you know what happened with that big relic temple in Singapore? They're supposed to have a Buddha's tooth there. And a dentist went to see it and said, that's not a Buddha's tooth, that's like a bull's tooth, a cow's tooth. Could recognize it. And this temple had just spent, I don't know how many millions, about 50 million or something, building this huge temple, you know, for this relic, and they find out it was a cow's tooth. It was a scam. But anyway, there we go. Is Nibbida disengaged, same as the Nimitta, bright light? Please explain. Okay. No, the bright light has nothing to do with Nibbida yet, except that you've let go of many, many things. Nibbida is like seeing something. So what am I holding this for? Nibbida, please excuse me, is like having some excrement, you know, on your hand when you've just been to the toilet. If you have even a little bit of excrement on the hand, you know, you get disgusted by it. You want to wash it off. You want to get rid of it. That is Nibbida. So what happens is, after a while, you think, what am I doing? Sort of worrying about the world for, worrying about just the stock market, worrying about my family. They can look after themselves. You get Nibbida towards this. I don't want this at this time. It's like a dirty, smelly thing which I'm carrying around. And because that means you actually push it away, you let it go. I call Nibbida the nature's ejection seat from the wheel of samsara. If you just, you know, let things be, you keep, you know, sticking onto the wheel. You need to actually push yourself off. And when you say, oh, what am I doing this for? Then actually that's called Nibbida. So once you get the Nimitta and then you get into jhanas, when you come out of jhanas, you start to look at what you've been doing in life. Now that's what, like taking alcohol, that's what happened to me with alcohol. What am I doing this? This doesn't make any sense. And so I got Nibbida towards alcohol, and that's how I gave it up. Sometimes people like smokers, smoking cigarettes. And that sometimes they look at themselves, they get disgusted at themselves. What am I doing this for? And that means they give it up. Anyone who has any other sort of addictions, like gambling, or even getting angry. And if you get angry and sort of shout at your partner and your loved ones, the problem with anger is you don't realize what you're doing, because your total focus is on the object of your anger. Now, the person you're shouting at, that's all you see. You never see yourself when you're getting angry. This is one of the reasons why, if anyone has chronic anger in your family, you now have the opportunity to make them mindful. You actually video them on your smartphone when they're getting angry, when they're violent at you, whatever. Take a video of them. And when they cool down, show it to them. This is what you look like. Because when they're getting angry, they can't see that. They don't know that. They're not aware of that. So when they see, is this what I look like when I get angry? Yeah. That is a huge embarrassment for them. You're actually cultivating their mindfulness. This is what you look like when you get angry. This is how you behave. And if that doesn't work, then put that video on YouTube. That would embarrass them. And then they'll get nibbida towards these things, and that will mean they stop. How did you happen to come to Australia? Why did you decide to stay? Well, that's an easy answer. When I went to stay, when I committed myself to stay with Ajahn Chah, I made a vow. I would never ask to go anywhere. Now, he would send me, and I'd always go wherever he sent me, and I wouldn't sort of ask or do anything by myself. So he would send me to this monastery and that monastery, and then one day he sent me to Perth to be with Ajahn Jacaro, and about a week or 2 weeks later, that's when he had his stroke, he couldn't speak anymore. So I was stuck, and I've been stuck here ever since. My karma, absolutely honest, that's what happened. Because it was just a letting go. I wouldn't sort of decide I don't like to stay here, I want to stay there. That was, to me, too much wanting. So if I'm sent to Perth, I'll make it work, I'll stay here. And because, you know, that was my vow, and he died before I could get released from it, you know, I'm really stuck, I've been stuck here ever since. It's a nice place, he made it work. Would you be willing to share? Oh, yeah.
I've heard that Ajahn Sumedho asked you to stay with him in England, but Ajahn Chah said no.
Yeah.
Do you know why?
I don't know why, but I think I sort of know why, because Ajahn Chah, when I went to visit England, and I was about that time when, you know, you should be helping out someone else, been in Thailand a long time, and Ajahn Sumedho said, you know, he sent the message over to Ajahn Chah, you know, can Ajahn Brahm stay in England? But he gave the message to Ajahn Jacaro to ask Ajahn Chah. And really, it's the way you ask a question. So, you know, I think that Ajahn Jacaro asked, yeah, there's a request for Ajahn Brahm to go to England. You don't want him to go to England, do you? Because he wanted me to go to Australia. So, you know, he asked the question. But you've got to be careful when you actually ask someone to ask a question for you. You know, sometimes they ask a question, but in such a way they get the answer which they were looking for. So that's a careful. I think that's what happened, quite frankly. Would you be willing to share what level of jhanas you have experienced? But I can't do that because of the Vinaya. Paticca number 8. So, but look, you can make your own guesses. That's as much as I can say. So what's the point? What is the point of all the body and the five senses suffering? What's the point of being born, only to mostly suffer, with most people totally unaware of the higher states, and then we'd be reborn to suffer another unaware life? What's the point of our suffering? And this continuous cycle. And then to finally become enlightened and realize it's all nothing anyway. Seems a long, hard road to travel, almost a joke. So what's the point? You've got it. In the end. The last sentence seems a long, hard road to travel, almost a joke, so what's the point? It is a joke. But you don't get it. It's all right to think like that, but do you know that? There's a lot of difference between having that idea and actually really knowing it. So it is true. In the sense that we know we're here to learn, to understand, to grow and understand what happiness is. We make many mistakes. And sometimes, again, as I mentioned a day or two ago, most people go to Buddhism because they want to make their will, or their sense of self, smarter, to train themselves, improve themselves. And that's the idea of self-improvement. And there's something very wrong in that, again, the self wanting to be improved. And I always like the story of the guy who went to the bookshop. And he went to the counter of the bookshop and said, "I'm looking for the self-help section." And the person at the counter said, "If I told you, it would defeat the purpose." But why are people always trying to improve themselves? If you really found out who you really were, you're stuffed anyway. You can't be improved. You know, so you might as well, instead of trying to improve yourself, let go of yourself. Now that is Buddhism. So instead of trying to make yourself better, you'd make yourself a little bit better, but it's endless. There's always things wrong with you. Instead, find out who this self is. So that's the meaning of life, finding out who you are. Now, what is this thing which is listening to me? Why do you make these choices? Why? And when you find out what the will is and what consciousness is, then you're on a roll. Then you find out why you're here. Because when they say, you know, why am I here? You don't know what this I is. Find out that first of all. And then the rest of the question will be actually quite easier to understand. Or remember what Ajahn Chah told me? When he said, "Ajahn Brahm, why?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "I'll tell you the answer anyway. There's nothing. That's the answer. But do you understand?" No. The purpose of your life is to understand that. Why? There's nothing. Do you understand? If you did, you'd be enlightened. Anyway. My fear is that after death, I will be reborn as a non-Buddhist in some remote corner of this earth or galaxy with tentacles as an alien. Can you be reborn as an alien? Somebody asked me in Indonesia. It's an interesting question, isn't it? It's actually, to get reborn, number one, you know, you have to have the karma to be reborn as an alien. And number two, you have to want to be. So if you've been watching too many sci-fi movies, and maybe you will be. Maybe, you know, because I know that some people are really into Star Wars. Maybe you might be reborn, you know, like, what's his name, Yoda, with big ears. That's what you really want. So it really is your craving, your wanting, and your karma. Those are the two forces which define where you'll be reborn, where you want to be reborn, how you want to be reborn. Was that case? There's one guy here, he told me, he said when he dies he wants to be reborn as a dog. He told me that, he wants to be reborn as a dog. And I was really stunned. What do you want to be reborn as a dog for? And he said because dogs don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. They can sleep all day, they get really good food, and they get exercise. It's a really good life as a dog in a modern city. Just play around all day. All you need to do to get really nice food is to wag your tail and lick somebody, and they give this incredible food. And you get really free health care. Oh, you get a really good life as a dog. He said, especially in Australia. And I could see his point. Until I told him that if you're born as a dog, in the first weeks of your life, you go to the vet to get de-sexed. And when he heard that, he said, "I don't want to be a dog anymore." So he changed his mind. You know why. Anyway, so you get born where you want to be reborn. And look, if you're a Buddhist, if you're inclining towards Buddhism, of course you'll be reborn as a Buddhist. Now the Buddha's teaching on this, and it was a very nice teaching, said, like, imagine a tree in the forest. It's leaning, you know, to the south. It's really heavily leaning to the south. Once it sort of dies or falls over, it will fall to the south. That's where it's leaning. All its weight is in that direction. He said, it's the same as people who are Buddhists or they're practicing meditation. That's where they're inclining all their life. Of course they're going to get reborn as a Buddhist. Because that's where you're inclining. That's what you're doing all your life. So anyway, So any tips on how to get my visa stamped at the last moment so I'm born into a Buddhist family in a Buddhist country, preferably Sri Lanka? Look. Don't know why you want to go to Sri Lanka, because Buddhism is actually declining in Sri Lanka. It's growing in Perth. So that's where you should try and get reborn. I really want to become a stream enter because I don't want to be reborn in the lower realms in the next life, or even to be reborn as a human but following another religion. I don't want that. Besides, having a short nibbana in seven lifetimes is kind of nice, so I can be lazy in the next six lifetimes. If you think like that, you're not going to get anything. But getting a jhana is so difficult, and it's already Tuesday. It's not, it's Wednesday. This must be yesterday's question. I'm getting anxious here. Maybe this is hard. I don't want jhana anymore. Can you lower down the standard? They're really getting desperate now. Well, okay. If you give a big donation, I'll lower the standard. Corruption. I can't do that. This is laws of physics, laws of the universe. I do have complete faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. Plus, I've been keeping my five precepts in daily life. Is that enough to get a ticket to Sri Wendy? If not, can you give a discount? Okay, you need to follow the instructions about letting go, being content. If you want to be a stream winner, that's too much wanting. You won't get anything. So give up all hope of being a stream winner, then you've got a chance. So people say, okay, I'm not going to be a stream winner, I'm not going to be a stream winner, I give up all. Why am I a stream winner yet? So do it properly. No contentment. You don't become a stream winner. That's I getting something. Remember, just get the understanding. There's nobody in there. So how can I be a stream winner? When the I vanishes, then you're a stream winner. So you're going about it in the wrong way. Trying to attain things, trying to want things. It all comes from the sense of self. Oh, please let that sense of self vanish. Where there's will, there's a self. This is another point which I've noticed, and you're saying about monks. Monks and teachers who meditate with strong willpower, they just create a bigger sense of self. It's the will is actually the creator, the cause of a sense of self. You've seen that. You know, I once went over to Melbourne once for the Commonwealth service, part of the Commonwealth Games. And I think with Ajahn Sujata, about three or four times we kept bumping into John Howard in this event. And you know, he has a lot of willpower, an incredible ego, very arrogant. Now, this is personal observations. People who get lots of willpower become very arrogant. The sense of self is huge. And when I see that, you know, general principle, there's some people who work very hard who are very selfless. But for the general part, those people who get to their meditation and just use a lot of willpower, they become big egos, big sense of self. The will strengthens the ego. So if you want to become a stream winner, don't use willpower. Your ego gets more and more solid. Let go, renounce, be kind, selflessness. And every act of kindness, selflessness, every act of letting go, you are weakening your sense of self. That's why this path is difficult, which I teach. Because what I'm really telling you to let go of is yourself. No attainments. No trying to achieve things. That's all self. Letting go of your past and future. Your thoughts. This is all stuff which defines you. Who you are. Being kind. Letting go. Things disappearing. Your body disappearing. So you don't know if you're a man or a woman. All these things you think you are, I'm asking you just to put aside. Your meditation just for a short time. Because you're not up to putting it away forever. But let it go for a short time. See what it's like. And then you can let it go forever. So you're not there anymore. Oh, what bliss. So this is actually the path. And this is one of the reasons I'm really, really strong on not putting forth effort. It's nothing to do with whether you achieve things or you don't achieve things, but everything to do with the fact that that effort, that struggle, that striving is what creates the ego. One of the reasons why the Buddha struggled and strived for 6 years, or before he became a Buddha, got absolutely nowhere, because it was strengthening his sense of self. He was doing it. He was trying to beat down the defilements. And by trying to beat down the defilements, you're actually building up this sense of me. And then eventually that he realized it's not going anywhere. Remembered a jhana he did as a kid because of his previous life under Kassapa. And then he just said, maybe this is the way. And the jhanas, they're stages of letting go. Things disappearing, you vanish. And even in Christianity, you know, there seem to be a couple of people, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross in the 13th or 14th century sometime. It seems, I'm not convinced, but there's, you know, maybe they may got jhanas. And you know what they called it? They called it surrender. Surrender to God, they called it. But it was a letting go of themselves, their ego, their wanting. They didn't want anything, they surrendered all their wanting to the process. And when they got into these stages, they called it union with God. They weren't there anymore. It was a selfless state, and what they experienced, they interpreted as, you know, union with God. They had vanished, they had totally surrendered. And I remember sort of saying that that may be one of the reasons why they got those states. They let go of all trying, all force, all struggle, and just gave up. And that is the path. You have to give up your sense of self, ego, me. So you're not trying anymore. And I've noticed that the people who go on the path of struggle and strife, and they get big egos, and even as monks, teachers, they're really hard to live with. Control freaks. That's how they practice their meditation, trying to control their mind. That's how they practice, you know, being a leader, controlling. And that's one of the reasons why they get angry, why they don't have any peace. The self gets bigger and bigger and bigger. They don't achieve stream winning. If you want to achieve stream winning, you've got to let go. You weaken the sense of self every time you meditate by not doing anything, by letting go. To, you know, okay, here we go. This was written on the philosophy wall of Cambridge University when I was a student. Graffiti. First line of this graffiti. To do is to be. René Descartes. You know, the great French philosopher. To do is to be. Jean-Paul Sartre, last century. Turn it around. To be is to do. The existentialist philosophy. And all summed up by the contemporary, he actually died a few years ago, the contemporary American philosopher, Dooby Dooby Doo Frank Sinatra. But whatever that, you know, joke was, you know, to be is to do is to be, Dooby Dooby Doo Frank Sinatra. Really funny. But they made the, you know, those two great philosophers, you know, Sinatra wasn't a philosopher, but, you know, those two philosophers, to do is to be and to be is to do, they made that sort of connection there, which is very fundamental. When you do things, you create the self. When you don't do things, you vanish. And that's how I've been teaching meditation. That is the way to be a stream winner, if you want to. Try to be a stream winner. Let go of your sense of self. Then stream winning happens. Anyway, regarding last night's Q&A, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble again. You said we go to refuge to the institution of monks and nuns because they renounce. This is clearly wrong to me, since it impedes our personal growth and confidence in ourselves in finding truth within. Even if there is no self, I feel our critical and analytical faculties should be exerted, or else, like someone said, we are conforming to a cult. yes, this is Ajahn Brahm's cult, and I have been brainwashing you for the last 4 or 5 days. Unfortunately, it's too late now for you. You have been brainwashed, and you're part of my cult. It's not a cult. And also, just what I said there, your critical faculties are totally conditioned. They are not critical. You can't think outside the box. You have to stop, be perfectly still, and then you're outside of the box. Then you think outside the box. That's why we have to leave our body, leave our mind, and then you start to see things. So I do not respect any teaching that places a refuge outside of within ourselves. That self of yours, that is the cult. That is a fallacy. You are a member of the cult of yourself. And to be able to overcome that, you've got to let go of things. A lot of times it's like a fear and a pride and ego which stops us taking refuge. Didn't Gautama Buddha say to be an island unto ourselves? He said to be an atadipa, an island to ourself. But that didn't mean a self. It meant just to learn these things. Have faith in the Dhamma. He said that as well, you know, to follow the great teachers. But in the end, never allow those teachings to stand in the way of truth, but doubt your truth. And how you can doubt your truth, what you think, if you have suffering, if you have fear, if you get angry, then you still have things to do in this life. So don't stop. I suspect you might be attached to the sense of self you've created as a monk all these years. Absolutely not. The sense of a monk is actually a non-self. Nothing here. That is how non-self things manifest. So it's amazing how people think you can be attached to a life of renunciation. There was this really crazy guy called Osho or Rajneesh, who he famously said, "I am so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment." Which is a nice way of excusing having so many Rolls Royces and so many girlfriends. And people bought that. He said, "Oh, monks and nuns, you know, you're just following old traditions, you're attached. I am not attached." Because he was actually teaching people to believe what they wanted to believe. It was very comfortable to have a spirituality where you can have lots of Rolls Royces, as much sex as you want, drink alcohol, whatever you want, and think it's spirituality. And people were dumb enough to believe in that. So now, by their acts you shall know them. Even Jesus said that. Look at monks and nuns, look at lay people. Who are the most peaceful? Up to you. Anyway, thank you for the relaxing and insightful opportunity. Yes, I agree. Is that my handwriting? No. Dear roundest of roundnesses. Here we go. Dear roundness of roundnesses, aka roundness with emptiness in the middle, or donut. That's my new. That's excellent. That's quite accurate. So your roundness with emptiness in the middle, or donut. Donutness, or the donutiest professor. I don't actually have a question. You are amazing, though. You make me feel very content. Love, a secret. Amara, P.S. Yes, it's me again. The straight, although questions are now being asked about how straight, which I understand, make under the circumstances, celibate male, Okay, but that's actually quite nice to be called a donut. I quite like donuts. So it's really true. Round on the outside, empty on the inside. What happens to the mind when a person becomes enlightened? Does dream meaning only happen after the fourth jhana? Okay. It's uncertain whether you need jhanas to be a stream winner. So it's not clear, but there's monks like me, there's other monks as well, agree with me. Yes, you need at least a jhana. Because the Buddha gave the Eightfold Path. And the last factor of the Eightfold Path, Sammasamadhi, is jhana. And the Buddha never said anything else. It's always jhana. And if jhana wasn't necessary, out of great compassion, the Buddha would have given a sevenfold path. But he made eightfold path, which means that jhanas is necessary. It doesn't matter how many people argue, you look at the sutras and it's right there and you can't get away from it. So yes, you do need, not the fourth jhana, but just at least one jhana is necessary for streamlining. And what happens to the mind when a person becomes enlightened? It means you no longer look upon this mind as you or yours. It's just a process, that's all. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's just mind as a process, just like I like to look upon it as one of these meteors which goes around the solar system, round and round and round, for millions of times, just like people go round the round of rebirths called samsara, being born, getting old and dying, just like these meteors going round and round the solar system. But then, every now and again, one of those meteors, they actually meet planet Earth. They meet the Dhamma. And you see that in the night sky, the shooting star. There's a blaze of light. And then their journey is over. The end of the meteor. That's like this process, which you think is a self, is just a process, that's all. Finally meets the Dhamma and goes out in a blaze of light and glory, the Arahat. And then it's gone. Poof. Out of samsara. Its journey ended. That's what happens. You like that? And people say, no, that's so negative. It's only negative if you think you exist. If you think you are, then it's negative. When you realize there's no one there, it's actually quite nice. You went to Cancer Support to give a talk for those under terminally ill. You told them to accept and prepare to die. You give them support and told them to meditate. Thank you. What did I do? I don't know. But I give Cancer Support. I don't. Some are terminally ill. Actually, you're all terminally ill. You know the definition of life? What is life? Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Think about it, that fits. Life is sexually transmitted from your parents, now it's to you, terminal disease. So welcome to life, sexually transmitted terminal disease. You're all terminal. And some of you are more terminal than others. So some of you are closer to the terminal. And I often say this because, you know, I did Mass before. So, yes, there's how many people here? There's 60 people supposed to be here. You know, a few sort of blow-ins from over the road. Maybe there's about 80 people here. So, quick calculation. Yes, maybe about 1.5 of you will be dead by this time next year. Statistics. Has to happen. 1.5 of you won't be here next year. You'll be dead. So, which are they? Don't just look at the old people. People of your age die as well, you know. Are you ready for it to be you? Where are my eyes going to stop? Are you ready to die? I'm ready. I've already given my instructions. You know, people telling bad jokes in my honor at my funeral service and in the recycling bin for my funeral. So, you did give them support because, you know, when people are got terminally ill, I don't like the word terminally ill because no one knows, you know, when you're going to die. There's so many people I know who have been considered to be terminally ill who are still alive today, you know, years afterwards. No doctor knows. And even when I became a young monk, there was this guy, Ajahn Tate. And he was in Sirirat Hospital when I first became a monk, terminally ill with cancer. And the doctor said, no more we can do for you. And so he said, well, if I'm going to die, I might as well go and die in my monastery in Muk Peng over on the Mekong River. And it was about 25 years later he died. So much for being, actually, they were right, he was terminal, but it took 25 years for him to die. So some of the doctors, sometimes what you say, you do your very best, but you don't really know what happens. And if you do some meditation, again, amazing things can happen. There's one guy, just another guy. I did the told you the story of the guy with the tumour in his nose. There's another guy who came from Malaysia who comes every year to Bodhinyana Monastery from Malaysia to give a donation because he had stage 4 lung cancer. Basically, that's the end of you. But, you know, because of what I taught him and some meditation, he just got into remission. So every year he gives me a little, like a fee for another year's life. Is that right, a fee? Well, it's a donation, really. But it works. I've seen that so often, which is why people with cancer, they often come to meditate. I better carry on with this, lots of questions. When watching the breath, sometimes I see my habitual tension and negativity, and it's really obvious in between the in and out breaths. Usually this means I wander off eventually. I have a feeling to keep watching. I feel almost immobile sometimes. Should I interrupt this to deal with the restless negativity? Well, don't have any gaps between the breaths. As soon as you finish breathing in, breathe out straight away. As soon as you finish breathing out, breathe in straight away. So when there's no gaps, there's no problem. Why? Just be peaceful, be quiet. And then those things don't happen. Just let it go, be kind. Why is it that some ladies are laughing so loud? An Asian pandit has said ladies should not smile, exposing their teeth. Who the heck was that? This is sexist, discriminatory, and if ladies have got good teeth, you spend all that time going to a dentist to make them look nice and straight, why not show them off? I don't see why not. Ajahn, I'm grateful for your descriptions of the states of jhana and nimittas. I knew some teachers would not describe these states because it sets expectations and creates a craving to experience these states of deep meditation. Ironically, the greatest obstacle to actually experience it. So I find myself directing my efforts towards letting go of these cravings. The effort, however, seems to create resistance to what is. We shouldn't be forcing or telling the mind what to do. Right, correct, just let it be. Yes, is this right effort? Yes. Right effort is the effort to renounce, to let go, to stop, to say no. That's right effort. Not the right effort to get something, but to renounce. It's the effort which is really well described by the three right thoughts or right intentions, which actually comes before effort. And those are nekama, sankapa, letting go, avayapada, kindness, ahimsaka, gentleness. We all know ahimsaka from Mahatma Gandhi. And that's actually, those are the three right intentions, which is where effort is supposed to be coming from. You have the intention to let go, to renounce, and the effort follows afterwards, to let go, but never to attain. Kindness, not ill will. Gentleness, not this terrible force which some people meditate with. It's crazy stuff. So what effort? That is actually effort to let go. And if you let go, yeah, I have to teach you about the jhanas and the nimittas, because otherwise it's really unfair. I'm not teaching you what's going to happen. And then I now taught you what the jhanas are, nimittas are. Now you teach, you know, how to achieve those. And it is by letting go, by kindness, not by struggling and striving. And on the way, you are letting go of your sense of self. Dear most extreme over-roundness, the uber-roundness. This morning you told us how to overcome the hindrances, doubt by following peace and ill will by having gratitude mind. What about the other hindrances? The anger and eating demon and kindness can be applied to restlessness and remorse. Is that what it's supposed to address? But those are the other two, sloth and torpor, as well as sensual desire. Please give some more tricks and stories to overcome these hindrances. Now remember, just sloth and torpor is because of tiredness. You've worked your mind too much wrong effort. That's why we get tired. That's why I've deliberately asked you to rest a lot. And this is not indulging you. This is in order for you to have more chance of getting deep meditation. To overcome the worst cause of sloth and torpor, which is tiredness. The restlessness is caused by lack of being at peace with yourself. Basically, the lack of kindness. Why is it your mind always runs away? It's because you've been such a control freak. It sees you coming, I'm out of here. That's what the mind does. If you have a good attitude to your own mind, a kind attitude and never wants to go anywhere. Do you like hanging out with me? If you do, it's because I'm kind. Like I used to like hanging out with Ajahn Chah and this monk Ajahn Tay. Didn't want to leave him. Why? Because he was so incredibly kind and non-judgmental. At last I could be with somebody who had never criticized me. I didn't need to be afraid. I felt so incredibly safe, peaceful, and respected, loved. That's why I never wanted to go anywhere. And I realized that is the trick to overcoming restlessness. If you feel safe with yourself, content, happy, non-judgmental, then your mind will stay with you. Certainly because you keep judging it, keep criticizing, it's never good enough for you. That's why it runs away. Have you ever had a partner in life who's really critical to you, always fierce, never really kind to you? You want to leave them. That partner is your mind. So be kind to your mind. And it stays with you. That is how to overcome restlessness. I'm going through this quickly because there's a huge amount here. And I wanted to sort of get most of them done. Dear Ajahn, we will all die one day. Speak for yourself. Yes, I will as well. What do you recommend to do with the ash? It always happens. Same question. This is a weird question. It keeps recurring again. Should we keep the ash, and so where should we keep it? If not, what should we do with it? Get in the ashtray. It's funny how people are thinking together and asking the same questions. I'm just reading this out. I'm not making this up. Different handwriting. I woke up this morning with the intention of writing to you to tell you the retreats are too cheap. Imagine my surprise when you spoke about it in your morning talk, programming or psychic powers. Back home we are given 3 payment options for meditation retreats. BW, medium and high. What's BW? Must be bottom. Low. Oh, low. Not low, medium and high. Even $500 would be too cheap for these retreats. You should give people the option on the web, a booking page of giving a one-off donation. Just one-off. 2-off, 3-off. Come on. Just like when booking an airline ticket, you tick a box and $10 goes to charity. Or set up a BPAY number for Bodhinyana. You can always give some money afterwards, you know, at the end of the retreat. But the main point is, we don't want to link money with the opportunity for coming here. So everybody can come in. Without any consideration, we don't sort of like on airlines, the people who pay the most money get the best seats. Is that the case here? The people with the best money sit in the front? And this is business class up the front. And it's economy class at the back over here. No, it's not going to work like that. Everybody's welcome. So we try and get rid of the money things. Actually, I was just writing and I was doing all this other stuff. A little article, and somebody asked me, "Isn't that as a monk not having to deal with money? How do you regard money?" And I gave the story of Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah, he predicted one day they'd run out of metal for coins, run out of paper for banknotes, so instead they would have to use chicken shit. And all these business people would be going around and in the big CBDs with pockets full of chicken shit, and the banks would be full of shit, and the governments would always be complaining they don't raise enough chicken shit from their taxes, and the IMF would become the International Manure Fund. Well, honestly, what's the difference between pellets of chicken shit and banknotes? It's only the value we give on them. So don't give value to money. Give value to people, to kindness, to generosity. Give value to peace. It's far more valuable. In fact, we used to say these retreats are so valuable that they are priceless. They're not free. They're priceless. So how can you put $500, $1 billion, $10? You can't put a price on them. So that's why you can't charge for the retreats. You just give a donation afterwards. But this is not for the retreat. The retreat is priceless. How is the man-made lake in Jhana Grove being used? Support the retreatants. It's interesting to know how you plan the design of Jhana Grove. The man-made lake is not a man-made lake. It's a monk-made lake. Yeah, I mean, every now and again, someone gets an idea, we do a bit of landscaping, see how it goes. We got no real idea, we just take it as it comes. On a retreat, you don't think about anything, but afterwards, maybe you might add a bit here, take a bit there, and see how it goes. Dear Ajahn, you advise not to put effort onto our mind while doing meditation. How can we follow right efforts, which is one of the Eightfold Paths, without making effort onto our mind? Exactly. Now, has a Buddha said right effort? He said, whatever it takes to arouse wholesome qualities and get rid of unwholesome qualities, basically. And what makes wholesome qualities and unwholesome qualities? This is what I was saying this morning with the simile of following the stream down. What do you have to do to make peace, kindness, that your meditation, you feel it's working? Whatever that is called right effort. And this is how you learn what right effort is. And it's not the same effort you use in life to get things done. It's not the effort I use to get jhana growth built. That's a totally different type of effort. The effort in meditation is different. It is letting go. Remember, before the Buddha became enlightened, he put his bowl in the river Nirmala to see if he had what it took to become enlightened. It was like an omen. And his bowl floated against the stream of effort. Usually says craving, but I'm going to call it effort. Against the stream of effort. Goes in a different direction than normal. The usual direction is doing things with effort. This is the opposite direction, not doing things. That is the path to enlightenment. Can you please clarify the difference between being kind to yourself versus too much of something, e.g. greed? Greed is not kind to yourself. It just causes you too much problems. You know that so often these people who come to the monastery, mostly Thai people, they said there's a lottery. I said, yes, what is it? Yesterday is the 25 million lottery. And there was a 25 million lottery, Ajahn Brahm. We'll give you 10%. Can you please give us the numbers? So I was messing around. I said, look, at least 50-50. And then getting serious, what on earth do you want to win a lottery for? And that's actually too much greed causes you too much suffering. Middle way, as long as you've got enough money to pay the bills, to live a reasonable lifestyle and also to make merit, what more do you want money for? You don't need heaps and heaps and heaps. In fact, those people who do have lots of money, it is a bit of a burden. And knowing where to invest it and how the stock market is going, being afraid your family or lawyers will come in there and take it all. And that's the problem. You see that in the newspapers all the time. These very well, Gina Reinhart having huge legal problems with her family. And why do they do that? Where there's lots of money, there's usually lots of greed. So that's too much of something does give rise to greed. So you find middle way. Do Ajahn empty in the middle? In the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Buddha says that the vijnana, which is the consciousness of every conceivable kind, is anatta, anicca, dukkha. And elsewhere was vijnana as a synonym for mind. Yeah, fair enough. If mind in jhana is perceived as stable and happy, how and when does the insight arise that vijnana is anicca and dukkha? Yes, it's got here just like fish and chips is anicca and dukkha. Actually, that's very true. Fish and chips is very impermanent, especially on my plate. Doesn't last that long. But no, this is actually where, when you get into, say, a first jhana, this was one of the reasons why those Christians never became enlightened, because when they got into the first jhana, they thought this was it, that this was incredible bliss, and they thought it was stable. They assumed it was God. But eventually, you get into a second jhana. You realize this jhana business is impermanent. And what you thought was the biggest bliss in the world, this is really important, it's an incredible thing to say. If you get into a first jhana, you think this is it. Many people think they're enlightened because they got into a first jhana. It's incredibly powerful. You're not there anymore. It's bliss beyond measure. But then later on, you get into a second jhana, which is infinitely more blissful than the first jhana. And that actually shows you the first jhana is actually suffering compared to the second jhana. But you know, compared to the ordinary life, the first jhana is blissful. It's just like when I went to India on pilgrimage. Oh, that was many years ago, and India was really filthy in those days. And then really bad air and just really filthy streets, and you had to go and, you know, those who've been on pilgrimage, you know, going to the toilet in the bushes, you know, wherever you go, and it was just really, really tough. And then the plane landed in Bangkok. Bangkok was so clean and pure. When I said that to people who know Bangkok, they thought I was crazy, because Bangkok is a dirty city too, but compared to India, Bangkok was so beautiful and clean. And then I went to Perth. Compared to Bangkok, Perth is just so incredibly clean and peaceful. I landed in the airport. And then I came to Bodhinyana Monastery. Compared to Bodhinyana Monastery, Perth Airport is so dirty and noisy. And then from the monastery, I went into my cave. Compared to my cave, Bodhinyana Monastery is so dirty and so noisy. And you realize just these comparisons. Sometimes you come to Bodhinyana Monastery, you think it's the most peaceful, beautiful place in the world. But then you go to my cave, and that really is peaceful and beautiful. And then you go into jhanas, and this is the cave is really noisy and dirty compared to jhanas. And this is actually what happens here. Yeah, you know, if you think just first jhana, if that's all you know, you think it's stable, it's happy, that that's the end, it's not suffering. You go to something else, and you realize that was suffering. And then Arthur Lakhana Sutra is right. You need a couple of jhanas to understand that. I get into peaceful state when I'm meditating, but once I am not meditating, I experience floods of uncontrollable thoughts, even when I'm sleeping. Result is I had nightmares and could not sleep well. Please advise. If you have nightmares, please take a pen and paper and write the nightmares down, because they could be scripts for a new movie. You could actually make some money out of your nightmares, because people love scary stories, you know, for the new movies. And they're just getting out of scary movies. We've had zombies, we've had vampires. People are just, you know, looking for something to scare. And if you have a really scary nightmare, write it down and send it to Hollywood. You can make a fortune. You could actually parlay your nightmares into actually having to retire afterwards. You don't need to go to work or anything. So it's a wonderful thing to have nightmares. Write them down. As soon as they're a wonderful thing to have nightmares and you really want them, you're looking this evening. I want a nightmare because, you know, I don't want to go to work on a Monday morning. I want to sort of get some money by sort of writing a script for a movie. Then when you want nightmares, you won't have any anymore, which means the problem is solved. Okay, making it up. Last question. There's a few left. Actually, more than last. So I didn't make any profit today. Dear His Exalted Roundness, if everything is conditioned, how will the process of cause and effect end? Because it's conditioned to end. Because it's conditioned to end. That means it ends. And why? What's the condition to make it end? It's the words of another enlightened being. They get in there and they stuff up the process. So they put the spanner in the works of rebirth. Once they put the spanner in the works of rebirth, then this whole process starts to unravel. The cogs stop moving. The fan belts break. And all the engines start to splutter and they don't carry on anymore. Your future existence is challenged. It is terminally ill. So the only way to actually overcome those conditionings which keep you going round and round and round is a Buddha arising in the world. And you have one. Whew. One more question. If there is no will, what is the cause for the ending of rebirth? Yeah, it's amazing. A Buddha. That is the cause. It can't come from you. You can't do it. Amazing to understand that. You need an influence. So, you know, I got Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had Ajahn Mun. You take it all the way back. It was the Buddha. Where did the Buddha stop his enlightenment, get his enlightenment from? He couldn't do it by himself. That was from Kassapa the Buddha. It keeps going backwards and backwards and backwards. Without Kassapa, there wouldn't be Siddhartha Gautama. Without Siddhartha Gautama, there wouldn't be, say, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah, or anyone else. This is the seed like the yeast which makes bread rise. Where does the first yeast come from? It keeps coming, going backwards. What I said the other day, time without boundaries, beginningless, no beginning, no end, round and round and round. That's very nice. So, even though the universe has no boundaries and time has no beginning or end, this talk does have an end. And the end is now. So time for you to begin to go back and go to bed. Sadhu! 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 Okay. So have a nice night. No nightmares tonight. So just, if you don't want a nightmare, just try and have one.